This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today I'm talking to Madeline Blaze. She's the author of the book called To the New Owners. It's subtitled A Martha's Vineyard Memoir. And because I have some experience going to Martha's Vineyard, the publisher, who's also a friend who goes to Martha's Vineyard, thought that I would like this book, and I absolutely loved it. So, Madeline, I really am so happy to have you to talk to about this book.
Well, thank you very much for having me on this podcast. I am excited to give it a go.
Well, I want to say at the outset that even though this book is about Martha's Vineyard, and I think it's necessary to talk about the place, I actually felt like this book had a broader impact on me and potentially on other readers. It is about a summer place that you end up leaving or you must end your relationship with. And the kind of entry point for the book is that your family house that you've been going to or your family has been going to for years and years is no longer in your family. I think that's an experience that lots of people have as we see the values of real estate changing. Maybe you want to talk about that a little bit, the kind of broader social milieu that you are writing from.
Well, I think it used to be, when I was a child anyway, that when people had summer homes, for the most part, they weren't particularly fancy, and they certainly didn't cost anywhere near what your winter home cost. And now the inverse is true, obviously, that houses on places like Martha's Vineyard or on Nantucket or in the Cape or parts of Long Island Sound or the coast of Maine are extremely expensive, and people routinely invest a fortune in them. And some of the houses can be modest, which can be very pleasant. Some are very showy, which seems somewhat jarring if you are used to, if you grew up with a vernacular in which the houses were kind of rustic and fit in with the ravages of the environment. When you're living on the coast, you know the kinds of storms you get, et cetera. You don't expect to see mansions, but now you do. And they seem odd.
And out of place. Yeah. I think it also highlights, I think about this in other parts of the country, the mountains of North Carolina and South Carolina and Georgia, which have become wildly popular for people who live in Charlotte and Atlanta, the Gulf Coast of Texas, which has become developed and now is, wildly expensive because people from Dallas come there, California, the Oregon coast, all these places which were, as you've as you describe Martha's Vineyard, kind of rustic and not necessarily built up. They were still, and Martha's Vineyard was still a farming and fishing community up until 30 or 40 years ago. And it just seems that there are levels of distortion there that are it's hard for people to get used to.
Well, the thing about Martha's Vineyard, and I think this is true of a lot of places, even posh places like it in New England, is that when it's not the high season, which is to say when it's not July and August, these places sort of revert to their ancient selves. And one thing I love about the vineyard is how New England-y it seems. When the vacationers have fled, gone home, gone back to their schools or their work or whatever, you have a very restful rhythm that reminds me of a lot of small towns in New England and elsewhere, where people really are neighbors, where they watch out for each other. They have, on the vineyard, they have a fund that starts up and you can start applying for it in the fall for children who are in need of holiday gifts. And there's just this sense on the island of how people are just facing the essentials, light and the lack of it in the winter, cold and more cold and what to do about it. And all of that, to me, that underpinning is, to the degree that it still exists on the vineyard and in places like it, is part of what appeals to me. It is less appealing sometimes thinking about the what happens during the summer, the crowdedness, how people are jockeying for partly for places by the for keeping beaches private, keeping people out of them. So they're trying to create all kinds of prestige for themselves. And you know, once they get what they want in terms of having a sort of a showy lifestyle, they're not really, it seems like part of the joy of that is making sure other people don't have it. And that's where I think places like the Vineyard lose sight of what they really have to offer, which is something that its beauty should be, I think, available to everyone. And it isn't always.
Well, and one of the things that I love a lot of things about your book, but the what you describe of the time period that the book takes place, which is when you married into the family, the Katzenbach family that owned this house, that had bought it a long time ago and kept it as a kind of, as you call it, it's a rustic retreat. It had, you know, maybe at one stage early on, not running water. And it seemed that the community of people that were in, you know, the people who went to Martha's Vineyard and summered there was a different, it felt like a different kind of set of connections that they had, you know, when you describe all the things that happened in the 60s and 70s, a much closer community.
Well, over the course of time, I identified what I thought were three major events or people or whatever that changed the nature of the island. And the first was Chappaquiddick, the tragedy in which during which Ted Kennedy at a party commemorating his brother and Bobby and his assassination the year before leaves the party with a young woman in the back of the car under circumstances that have never really been totally explained and ends up going off a little wooden bridge into the water, and he manages to escape from the car and she's left there and dies. And that publicity in 69 created a huge amount of attention for the island. Then just a few years later, Steven Spielberg chose Martha's Vineyard as the place to film the movie Jaws, which is in fact a great, great movie. And the publicity that came from that was a windfall for the island, but it started to change the nature of the island. It started to bring attention to it from across the country and even across the world, attention that it had not had before. It always had some famous, accomplished people who loved to go there in the summer, but part of what they loved was that they could get away from the brouhaha and all the noise of the world. And then in 93, I guess it was the summer of 93, when Bill Clinton came there to vacation, the island was so excited. The president was coming on vacation. Lots of welcome articles in the Vineyard Gazette, etc. But that created also its own groundswell of attention and people wanting to tag along on the prestige of being on this island. Those three things are the things that I think made a huge difference in terms of the sweep of time. The place that my in-laws had purchased was a piece of land on a peninsula on Great Tisbury Pond in West Tisbury on the Vineyard. And they initially bought land that had a little fishing shack on it. And when I first visited this part of the world with my future husband, we stayed at the shack. You could stand it maybe 3-4 days. It was practically like living outside. And you really were one among the elements, and two, lots of mice in the kitchen, et cetera, having what I called major mice conventions. And the kitchen wasn't much of a kitchen. It had a hand pump at the sink. That was about it. So it was that little house, though, had been used for years by the people who owned it as a fishing and a hunting shack. My husband's mother, who is a flamboyant sort of person and likes to think of things in terms of of drama, was convinced that it was an assignation spot for some captain from Edgartown and his mistress or whatever. But really, and I like that explanation, because otherwise it was just a guy with a gun in a shack waiting to shoot the geese that fly overhead, because it happens to be a geese, I've got to get the right word for this, but like a geese airway right above this particular part of the pond when they're migrating. At any rate, that shack was eventually torn down, and a modest one-story house was put up in its place when the neighbors first saw it, were concerned that maybe it'd be two stories. John's family paid all the neighbors the architectural courtesy of not building two stories. They purposefully wanted it to meld in with the landscape to be something that people eventually almost didn't notice. And the house at first didn't have electricity. The new house did have running water, however, but it didn't have electricity. Eventually it got that. Eventually it got a landline phone. It is impossible, at least it used to be for us, to get much of the internet when we were there. So we were pretty much without devices. We didn't have a TV. Sometimes we had a radio and listened to Red Sox games, but not often. So it was a sort of a primal place to be, primal and primordial. You were just out in the elements for the 2 weeks that we were apportioned, and you just learned to love the rhythms of the early dawn, and then late in the day, sitting on the deck and feeling the wind and the sweep of nature.
And of course, you spent years going there with family. And I think that becomes a kind of focal point for the book, and reflecting your story that your children went there every summer of their lives, and your in-laws and family members all spent time there. So it became this focal point for your family.
Absolutely. It was what you call a well-used house. It was from Memorial Day to through Labor Day, and then closing around Columbus Day, it was filled with people. And in our case, during our 2 weeks, I'd go with my husband, who's a writer, and our two children, a boy and a girl, and we would, and as they got older, they would invite their friends. We always made sure that it was a movable feast for everyone those 2 weeks, I think it was partly just wanting, in my case, wanting the children to have a really, really series of happy memories, which is basically what they have of this place. The other thing is that when we first started going there as a couple and as a young family, when the new house was built, John and I had heard about a place in Maine which is called AGA Correa's, Correa, that sells ship's logs, really authentic nautical ship's logs that have this fantastic paper that can withstand the elements. And we ended up buying one for the family as a house gift called Summer Notes. And in the end, over the course of the 40 years or so that we were using the house, 30 or 40 years, I can't do the math quite right now in my head, but at any rate, we had 8 books in all, and we called them different names like Son of Summer Notes, The Unending Summer Notes, and then they got a little more silly and more in-jokey, the names of the books, but at any rate, we kept this great ongoing record of what we did each summer. Whoever wanted to contribute could, and it was very verbally oriented. I should say that John's family is a very distinguished family. His father, Nicholas Katzenbach, was Attorney General during the Johnson years, the Kennedy-Johnson administration. He served in various capacities. And he was the man who is probably most famous in history for having stood in the schoolhouse door when George Wallace did not want the University of Alabama to be integrated. And John's father just stared him down, and eventually the federal law was enacted and the students were allowed to go to school there. John's mother comes from a very, like his father, but from a very old family. Her name is Lydia King Phelps Stokes Katzenbach. And although you would think that I would have been intimidated because John's father had been the Attorney General, I I always found him approachable. I felt shy around him. I felt like I should have gravitas. I mean, if I was going to ask for someone to pass the butter, I should also make a point about the Constitution at the same time, just so that everything's at a high level. But John's mother is particularly formidable, and I'm not the only person who says this. So they were these larger-than-life people who were very verbal, like myself and the family I come from. And we managed to keep these beautiful logs with John's father making entries, John's mother, other people, just talking about whatever moment on the island they wanted to preserve. And as a result, there's this record from over the years that people reading my book will get a sense of the weight of time and also how important it is sometimes to stand outside time and make note of a moment that's important to you. And particularly, I think the book is about being grateful. I mean, we live in a culture of excess to some degree and, of course, of extreme poverty at the other end of the scale. And it's hard sometimes to just have good perspective. But this is the logs in particular help create a narrative, an undercurrent within the book of just how important it is to have perspective and be grateful for what you have when you have it.
Yeah, that I thought that came across. I think to me, the logbooks are, I mean, of course, they're your family's stories, but they enable history to be remembered in this kind of indirect way. And the history that's memorable is not necessarily major events, although there are a couple in the book. I think that it's actually talked about in the logbooks. I think your daughter wrote, or maybe you quoted something your daughter wrote about it. But that was something that stood out for me, was when there was a man who was swept out to sea in the cut, that they, you know, they every summer open Tisbury Great Pond to the ocean, and this creates this great flow of water out of the pond into the ocean, and it's dangerous, as you point out.
Yeah, the cut is the opening of the cut is a big thing on the vineyard. It's kind of also a well kept secret because the authorities do not want, especially after this tragedy that occurred with the drowning, they don't want people crowding them when they're using the earth movers to create this channel of water that basically allows the Tisbury Great Pond, when it's about to overflow, to dump some of its water into the ocean and get fresh ocean water. Tisbury Great Pond is a saltwater pond, and that's part of how it stays healthy is having the cut be open from time to time. But the particular year that we're talking about, the kids were pretty little. We were on the deck and in the far, far distance with binoculars. We could see there was commotion on the beach and the cut was being open and great excitement, beautiful day. And everyone got in the boats or the canoes or walked or however they got. Everyone had different ways of getting to the beach. We all got to the beach and we got there. Because it was the first day of the cut, the water was really roiling. It was looked like class 5 rapids or something. And a man who taught at the high school, who had been was on that day, I think, on a health kick. He'd walked with a backpack a long distance to get to the cut. And if I recall correctly, he may have even been trying to give up smoking or something like that. But he sat on the edge of the cliff where the cut was, or the pretty much a small cliff, and he fell in, and then when he fell in, he got swept to sea, and you could see him just being swept out, and right away people tried to rescue as best they could. I think somebody had a cell phone. It was the earliest days of cell phones. Someone was able to call the authorities. The Coast Guard came, and they did eventually find his body, but they were obviously, by the time they rescued him, he was gone. But my daughter did write about this, as did another young person at the who was with us, and she wrote about this as part of something she was doing for when she was applying for college, as one of her essays. I was going to say that we have two college essays in this book. One is hers, and then another is an essay by a friend of hers who didn't have a house in the vineyard, but had family that would welcome her to stay there during the summers, and was able to get a job at Stop and Shop in Edgartown, a really hard job, as a cashier. And she saw people there who were really living from hourly wage to hourly wage. And she wrote a really beautiful essay about appreciating them and what they do to survive economically, and what they do for the island, for the people who come to visit. So there are other voices in this book besides mine, which I think is important to make clear to readers. And so there are other people who are speaking with just as much passion about something that the island has taught them or shown them than myself.
Right. I thought that was actually a very meaningful part of the book, the different voices. And you valued, I think there was a friend of the family's who was an editor for Consumer Reports, who wrote essentially a Consumer Reports review of her each summer. I thought that was great.
Her name is Leslie Ware, W-A-R-E, and she lives in Connecticut. And she and her husband, Phil Caputo, who's a novelist, would come to visit every year. And Phil in particular gets his own chapter called Phil, because he was the guest without whom vacation wouldn't seem to be vacation. And Leslie was part of that. But Leslie, she's just a very droll person. So she would just pretend that this was a product she was assessing year after year after year.
Yeah, that was wonderful. I mean, because she, yeah. Anyway, that was fun. I also thought another story that another element of the book that leads to stories is the presence of dogs, and your family was fairly obsessed with dogs, it seems.
Very upset. John's family. And there's a title called Mr. Ulf, Famous Writer, which is about a dog named Beowulf, who the family had him apply at one point to become a writer in the Famous Writers School, which was a kind of a boondoggle that existed in the 50s and 60s.
In Westport, Connecticut.
It was Connecticut. It was, yeah. And you took an aptitude test. So the aptitude test just was for the people to look at to see if you had any talent as a writer. So someone filled it out for Mr. Bayo W. Ulf, and who happened to be a Saint Bernard, and all his answers were: the sun rose in the sky today like a Saint Bernard. The dark and stormy night reminded the traveler of a Saint Bernard. A smile lit up her face like a Saint Bernard. Anyway, that dog did get accepted in the Famous Writers School, which made the family very happy. But we have rules for guests, and one rule that I always had for guests was like dogs or pretend to, because you weren't going to have a good time if you didn't try to see the world through the eyes of dogs.
And Martha's Vineyard is particularly popular, I think. Or let's say people who go there often feel the same way. I think dogs are a kind of regular occurrence at a lot of places that you go on Martha's Vineyard.
Absolutely. And even on the ferry on the way over, it's really sweet the way people have dogs of all sizes and shapes, and children will ask usually if they can touch them or pet them, and families want the children to feel comfortable around dogs. So the ferry is really almost like a dog ferry, and then sometimes people are on it.
That's true. Well, and of course there are, you know, the main ferry that you're talking about is the Vineyard Haven and Oak Bluffs ferry coming from Woods Hole. But there are now multiple other ways of getting to Martha's Vineyard that I'm sure current visitors use. There's so many, you know, ferries from Rhode Island and ferries all kinds of places.
Right. There's a ferry, I think, is it from Port Judith near Shelter Island?
Yep, the Port Judith one
Rhode
is
Island.
That, right, the high speed ferry. Yep. And of course, I think the airport at Martha's Vineyard has become much bigger because of all those private jets the truly wealthy. Now, it is also true, and you point this out, I think, that even in those earlier years, there were quite a few celebrity visitors and homeowners to the vineyard, aside from the two presidents who have gone there. And you talk a lot about Catherine Graham, who was the owner of the Washington Post, And she was someone who was a very important vineyard resident.
Absolutely. Well, she actually was a chapter called What Kay Graham Brought to the Table. And Catherine Graham and I met at a memorial service for a man named Howard Simons, who was, I always say, one of the underrated Watergate heroes, because he was the night editor on the Friday night of the break-in at the Watergate Hotel. And so he supervised the very beginning of the coverage. And he eventually ended up becoming the director of the Nieman Foundation, or the curator. And he died in 89. There was a service for him. I went down to Washington for it. And at the service, talked to Mrs. Graham, who we talked about the vineyard and how we would both be there. And she said, well, when you get to the island, be sure to call me, which I thought, oh, my God, I have to call her now, because he would never not call Mrs. Graham. I mean, I think there's going to be a movie based on Watergate with Meryl Streep, if I heard correctly, yes, which will be wonderful, because I think at this point, Mrs. Graham died in 2001, and I think a younger generation doesn't quite know everything about what she stood for and did in this world. But she was the publisher of the Washington Post, a paper she inherited from her husband, who had been given it by her father. So she kind of, and her husband had died tragically of suicide. She wasn't really prepared to run the paper, but she got it. And as she said, she just put one foot forward and did what she could do, and eventually has become known in the history of journalism as the most intrepid, I would say probably the most intrepid newspaper publisher we've ever had. And we have a rich history of wonderful publishers at times, and of course, incredible journalists who've tried to keep the Republic alive and truthful and in good shape. And she was there during the Watergate coverage, and she was the one who just allowed it to go on and on and on, and never pulled the plug, and just put herself, it was just the object of great disdain on the part of the then Attorney General, who said kind of crude things about her. And her life was probably at times in danger for what she was doing, but she just kept standing up for her reporters and for letting the truth be known. At any rate, she tells you to get in touch. You do. And as a result, we had a once-a-year summer rendezvous, either at her house, which was called Mohu, or at John's parents' house, which didn't have a name. Well, I guess we called it Thumb Point, because that's part of where it was on the island. But at any rate, she would come to us, and we would... I remember one time cooking lobster, because I thought, well, that makes everybody kind of equal. Everyone's getting juice squirted all over them. They're trying to crack things open. They have trouble with it. It's kind of festive. Another time I cooked swordfish on the grill. And what we used to do is buy the finest swordfish in the world from John's Fish Market in Vineyard Haven. And to cook it, I would sometimes put just the tiniest membrane of mayonnaise on it, and then we'd grill it. You didn't need anything else. But that little mayo helped seal in the flavor and create a crust. And she loved the recipe and wanted it from me. And I was so embarrassed that it was so simple that I said, oh, I can't tell you. You have to tell me who Deep Throat is, and then I'll tell you. And I was trying to think, what am I going to do? She wanted me to talk to her chef about it. And I think finally I did talk to the chef, and I said, listen, this is embarrassing. This is all I did. You know, this is the recipe, at any rate. But she was an icon, to say the least. And there was so much I admired about her. I can't believe, speaking of gratitude, I now can think back with such gratitude that for once a year, every summer, she was in my life, even if it was just somewhat tangential and just for a beautiful meal. But wow, she was there, and I really admired her.
No, it's wonderful for you to have had that experience. And I think, that's part of maybe the magic of being in a certain place where you do get to have opportunities that you might not otherwise. And you did, another thing that I thought was really interesting, and this I think predated your being on the vineyard, but was the story about Nicholas Katzenbach and the Gulf of Tonkin. and what happened on the vineyard. You know, this kind of incredible, you should talk about it, not me. And I thought it was a really great story.
Well, it's actually a family story that was in my husband's family that they didn't talk about a lot, which is to say that John's parents ended up first going to the vineyard, say, in the 1960s as renters, which is, of course, how many people begin their what ends up in home ownership at these beautiful places. And one summer, a group of island residents took out an ad in the Vineyard Gazette to addressing John's father because he was in the government and asking him essentially they made it sound as if he was supporting the war in Vietnam when he had in fact done something somewhat different, which is to say he'd been asked to rule on the legality of the Gulf of Tonkin resolution. And as Attorney General, he ruled that it was legal. That didn't mean he thought it was a good ruling or advisable, but it was legal. And these people took out an ad attacking him. It was something that really, I didn't see the ad until I started writing this book. It was really not something you brought up lightly. It was signed by very important and accomplished people on the island, mostly summer people, who were basically saying, in a sense, you're not welcome here. And one person, I think it was Robert Brustein of the Yale School of Drama, called John's father a good German, an expression that I know my husband really took umbrage with, because for 3 years during World War II, John's father was in fact a guest of the German government. He was in a POW camp. And I think that the one thing about John's father was that he radiated integrity. And so this particular interaction from these neighbors was very hurtful. And I've looked at the list of names of the people who signed the ads, and I know they were on the vineyard on and off for years afterwards, and I don't believe John's parents ever socialized with any of them again.
And there were a lot of the kind of vineyard social, the literary milieu that you might otherwise have seen. I also noticed, however, that Kingman Brewster defended your father-in-law.
He did. And also, you know, the other person who defended him, who was an amazing man, really, I mean, someone should write his biography, is Art Buchwald, who was a newspaper columnist.
Yes.
A man who was filled with love and light. I'm not kidding. That probably sounds, hope that doesn't sound new agey, but he had had a very, at times, he was an orphan. It wasn't an easy upbringing, but he became someone who survived and then prospered and had all this talent and just kept giving back and giving back and giving back. On the island, he was famous because every summer he ran the auction, the Impossible Dreams auction. And at the very end, the big finale was he would take his hat and auction it off. And when I wanted to quote he wrote a column about that ad that we're just talking about that came out shortly after the ad did. And the column is very measured. It's basically arguing for both sides to listen to each other, and also it's gentle towards John's father and trying to understand some of the pressures that were on him when he was asked to make this ruling. What's really interesting is that in the fullness of time, as I was writing the book and I wanted to quote the column, what's interesting to me is I contacted the Buchwald estate and family and was given, I think her name is Tamara Buchwald, permission to use the piece. Just, you know, no strings attached. Of course you can use it. And I think that's just the kind of people they are, kind of open and generous. So there's people like that that are attracted to the island that do help create a good spirit there. And Buchwald's spirit lives on, trust me.
I agree. But I was very impressed with or interested in reading more about Nicholas Katzenbach himself, because he is this figure in history, and you know, really obviously personalized him. Could you read the part from the logbook, which is, I think, written by him, which is the piece where he gives the operating instructions for, you know, it's a longer piece, so you're only going to read part of it, but it would be great to hear that.
Yeah, that's actually was written by John and me, but it was just the family. I want to get the page. What do you have the page?
I think it was 137.
Okay. This was a note that was sent to someone who was going to use the house that had never been there before. You are going to travel a total of 2.2 miles on a dirt road. It meanders around. Be persistent. Be confident. At the top of the hill, bear left. Continue past other houses. Watch for sandy spots. The house will either be open or there will be a key on the shelf of the outdoor shower facing the house on the extreme right. The key will open all doors. It might make sense to invest in an island map. It's very easy to get turned around and have trouble finding the right dirt road, especially at night. I think there's a map on the bookshelf in the living room. Poke around. A word to the wise. Take a load of groceries out there if possible. There is a Stop and Shop in Edgartown, cheapest, except nothing is cheap on the island. In Vineyard Haven and in West Tisbury, there are Kronig's, significantly more expensive, but very popular with the people who don't like chain stores. There's a Stop and Shop by the Vineyard Haven Ferry also. Fish. Go to John's Fish Market in Vineyard Haven. If Sandy is there, say you're staying out at our place. She's an original. Take her advice as to what is best. Some people swear by pools down in Menemsha, but we prefer John's and not because of the name. Vegetables. Many locations. Morning Glory Farm just outside of Edgartown seems the best. Eat island pies. There's a kiosk just outside West Tisbury called Eileen Blake's, since closed down. Not cheap, but absolutely primo. There are many other bakeries on the island, all with unique character and specialties, but her pies are by far the best. But you can get a good chocolate chip cookie all over the place. At the house, 3 kayaks and 1 motorboat. The fuel for the motorboat will either be in it or up in the storeroom just past the outdoor shower. It's a 4-stroke, so no oil mixed with the fuel. Everyone wears life jackets in the boats. When there's a southwest wind, it can sometimes pick up, this is pretty obvious, which makes going to the beach a wet adventure. Getting to the beach, beware of the shallows. Essentially, you head directly across the pond. You will see other boats gathered on the sand. Just head there. With the kids, be alert to undertow. Once you get to the beach, plop down anywhere.
That's wonderful. I mean, that's the perfect invitation, I think. And, you know, there's so many things. I think for anybody who's spent time on the vineyard, this book is lots of reference and agreement and disagreement. I actually agree with you about John's and John's Fish Market. Yeah. And also, although the pie thing is definitely changeable as time goes on, you know, every summer there's probably somebody new there making pies that are better than somebody else's.
Yeah. Eileen Blake's did go out of business. That was my husband's favorite. Mine, I actually, I liked them all, but it wasn't necessarily my favorite. We used to love a place called Humphreys that had the best blueberry pie in the world, in my opinion. But
well, there's somebody who makes pies and sells them at the Tisbury Farmers Market, and I haven't been to the vineyard in some years, so I person may not even be there anymore. But I always liked the Farmers Market for discovery too.
Farmers Market, terrific. I would say that it really is. There are a lot of pie is the dessert on the vineyard more than ice cream. Pie is it.
Although Mad Martha's is hard to, and then you've got there are people who are fudge people that obviously you're not because I don't think you mentioned it in the book. But the Murdoch's fudge people are just enthusiastic to no end.
I know. I think I did mention fudge. that sometimes, I mean, when do you ever think about fudge or saltwater taffy except when you're on an island, you know, off the coast of New England and suddenly they're there? But no, I'm not. I'm actually not a sweets person. So you'll see, I talk much more about the lobster and the swordfish.
Right. And you don't talk about chowder much. So you're not obviously.
I don't, not as much. I know. Well, I guess I like lobster bisque, but not every day.
And you also did talk about the horses on the, in Oak Bluffs.
Oh, the carousel, the flying horses. That's what when the children were little, all kids love it. It has that canned carnival music and the smell of popcorn. Right. And it's kind of a little bit worse for wear in the sense that it's kind of ancient. And, needs some upkeep that it does get from time to time. But children live for going to the flying horses and getting the brass ring.
Right, the brass ring. Who could not want the brass ring? Well, this has been really wonderful. I do want to say, I don't think I said this earlier, but the writing in this book is fantastic. It's just evocative and warm and inviting, and I thought irresistible. So I wanted to mention how good the writing is.
Well, thank you so much. It was a pleasure to do it and to work with the people at Grove Atlantic, which are, and particularly with my editor, George Gibson, who is a wonderful and talented person. And the cover of the book, I had suggested that they get a photo image from Allison Shaw, who's a wonderful photographer on the island, and they were able to do so. And so the cover is quite beautiful of the house, our shack, or whatever we want to call it, that no longer exists. The house that we sold was torn down by the new owners. So the house really now only exists in our imaginations and our dreams and our memories and in this book.
Well, and I think that's the purpose of the book is to, it's to tell not only your own family what happened there, but also to remind the new owners, not only of your house, but of any new house, that it's what happens with the people there that make it a house.
I completely agree. So I hope that other people who are fortunate enough to get new houses or to buy property in any of these wonderful spots realize that they are stewards of it and stewards of the memories of the people who were there. And it's their job to preserve.
Yes. No, I think that's a really good point. Well, thank you so much, Madeline. I really love talking to you about this book, To the New Owners, A Martha's Vineyard Memoir. I've been talking to Madeline Blaze. This is David Wilk, Writers Cast, a podcast about books and authors.